Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international coach, and the resident show stat guy.
It was a week of surprises and shakeups, particularly in the NCAA women's world. So if you are one of the few people who probably didn't have your social feeds bombarded by the big news, buckle up because you're in for a shock here in a couple minutes, okay?
I thought we were going to get away from the NCAA women's game this week with the transfer portal being closed, and then there it is.
We're back. In current league action, we have new teams atop the standings in both Love and the PVF. Same teams at the bottom, though, don't worry. And it was a very fun week for NCAA men's volleyball matchups. We are so excited to discuss it all with you, so let's get started. All right. In the news that shocked the volleyball community this week, Nebraska head coach John Cook announced his retirement, which created a sort of domino effect in a couple programs. So Danny Busboom Kelly will be taking over the head coaching job at Nebraska, which means Dan Meske, the former associate head coach at Louisville, will be the new head coach of that program. And as we found out a couple weeks ago or recently, Jordan Larson is out.
So before we talk about this seriously, do you think Dan Meske getting the head coaching job at Louisville, do you think his social media game will be greater or less frequent now that he's a head coach?
I really hope it's less frequent because I've never seen a coach post social media videos from their practice as much as he does. I hope it decreases. It's just a pet peeve of mine, but whatever.
You played for Nebraska. You knew John well. You played with Danny. You played with Jordan. Your opinion, everybody wants to hear your opinion. Everybody wants to know what you think. And then, you know, maybe I'll put in my two cents at the end.
I must admit, I was caught off guard when I got the news that Coach Cook was retiring, particularly because he had signed his contract extension to 2028, like last spring, summer-ish. I was surprised and I was trying to think, like, there's something else at play here. Like, what is going on? Then watching the press conferences, it's like, yeah, their second grandchild is expected in the family. A coach's life is unforgiving. They miss so much, and I can completely respect the fact that he wants to be there for his grandchildren in a way that he wasn't able to be for his children. I honestly think he expected to win a national championship with Lexi Rodriguez, and I think when that didn't happen, it kind of had him questioning, like, and again, I am speculating here. I do not know this 100%, but when you are so certain that you're going to win with a particular athlete and you don't, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, she was outstanding and we didn't win. So how long am I going to keep going searching for this? Do you know what I mean? Like, it could be never ending.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you think the window closing. Now, listen, Nebraska always has a chance to win. But if you look at their roster and what they had, if they were going to do it, it was going to be in these last couple of years. Now you have a little more uncertainty with other teams and how the conferences and the tournament looks. I was curious if that played a part in it.
Well, especially because coming into this season, they had lost zero players.
Yeah.
So they were primed to do it this past season. I think, you know, he is, if not 70, he's close to 70 years old already. Like, at what point are you just going to live your life? Do you know what I mean? And ride off into the sunset, no pun intended. I think, honestly, I was surprised, but I'm happy for him because it's like, at some point, you need to move on.
Every coach comes to that point in their career. When you coach, it's all you think about. It is all consuming. you can't do anything else well. You're always weighing the sacrifices of family, of being around, of doing that. Everybody comes to that tipping point in their life, and sometimes it happens quickly. And for him, it was probably, he might have woken up one morning and just said, I want to be with my grandkid. That's it. I'm done. And it can happen that quickly.
Like, I don't want to put myself on this level at all, but it's like, I can relate to that with my own recent retirement from playing. It's like, I physically could have kept going. I physically was capable of still competing at a high level, and I loved competing. But it's like, you can't do it forever. And there comes a point in time where you have to look at yourself and be like, do I want to keep down this path, or do I want to explore new options? So I can relate to the sort of decision-making of understanding, like, I am capable of doing this, but do I want to? And I feel like it's probably something similar. And I have a lot of respect for him for stepping away. He is the winningest coach of this century. He has created an incredible legacy at Nebraska. And he continued the tradition that Terry Pettit started and built it into this global standard of what women's volleyball can be. And I think that what he has done for women's sport and women's volleyball in general is unparalleled. And so it's the end of an era, and it's sad, but I also don't think they could have chosen anybody other than Danny to take over the program.
So this was the other thing I was going to ask you, is do you think having a successor in Danny, who from Nebraska, loves Nebraska, played at Nebraska, great coach, you saw what she did with the Louisville program. For me personally, I think handing something that you've built to somebody else for your whole life is, it's almost intimate. You want to know that that is going to be in good hands, that it's going to continue. And I wonder, you saw a bunch of people come through that program, notably, you know, Tyler Hildebrand, who I thought was potentially going to be somebody who could run that program, their current assistant coach. And I wonder if John just wasn't comfortable or didn't feel good about where the program was going to be. And I think Danny coming in and agreeing to do that probably eases his mind, because I think she's a great choice.
I don't think it could have been anybody else. And aside from Danny's success and pedigree, it would require somebody very special to walk into that program. Even from a public-facing perspective, like, expectations for the Nebraska volleyball program are high throughout the state, throughout the country. And I think to have somebody that is homegrown, that they can trust, that the fans can trust to take that program, like, it would not go well, I don't think, if an unknown person kind of came in. Danny has history. She won a national championship for the school. I just feel like there's that inherent trust from the public in bringing her in. And you might not like it, but that's a big part of it for Nebraska.
So a couple things about Danny coming in from my perspective. One is, I think technically she's taken athletes at Louisville and made a competitive program. I think she's going to be able to do that at Nebraska. I'm very curious to see what she can do now that she can recruit the best athletes. And I'm not saying she couldn't get them at Louisville, but playing at Louisville and playing at Nebraska are two different things. I'm curious to see how she shapes her roster with maybe a little more choice of athlete. The one thing which I think is going to be curious to see how she handles is, at Louisville, you were always the underdog. That program,
well, when you get to the end, in the ACC maybe not, but once you get to the Final Four, fair.
I'm talking about national championships. Mm-hmm. That's a different mentality than being the one that everybody's chasing. And how long does it take her to settle in? How does she handle that? Expectations are different. I think that's going to be the hardest part for her coming in, is that kind of shift between chasing and being chased. And I'm curious to see how she handles that.
Well, not to mention, it's not just about coaching when you're the head coach at Nebraska. The media requirements, the public engagement, like, there is so much that goes into being a head coach at that program aside from what happens on the court. And it is a lot of work. Again, I don't think it could have been anybody else. I am so happy for her. I think she deserves it. And like on a human level, I'm excited that her and her husband get to move back to Nebraska and be close to family. Like, I think that's amazing. It's a new era.
Quick take off the cuff here. Do you think Danny A wins more matches than Coach Cook by the end of her time at Nebraska? And do you think she wins more national championships?
My instinct is no. It is getting harder and harder to win, particularly in the conference Nebraska is currently in. You know, she's young, though. She's only like 39, going on 40.
She could coach there
for as long as she wants. So she's got a little more runway than Coach Cook did. That is a hard question. You don't just like casually become the most winningest coach of the century. You know what I mean?
There's so many things that are at play.
My instinct is no. Would I love her to do that? Absolutely. But that's tough.
Okay. And the final piece around this is Jordan Larson out as the assistant coach at Nebraska. What are your thoughts around that? She must have known this was coming. Do you think it was Danny's decision or do you think it was Jordan's decision? I have my own personal thoughts about this.
I don't know what Jordan is planning. So it's hard for me to answer that. What is your thought?
Nobody in Nebraska is Jordan. With her resume and her playing experience, I think for Danny coming in for the program to really be hers and for her to put her stamp on it, I think that's a really tough dynamic to manage. Because who do you go to? They were teammates. Jordan is, again, one of the best U.S. players to have ever existed. If they don't agree on something, there's an interesting power dynamic there.
It's like they're the same age pretty much, yeah, too.
I think it's a really hard dynamic for Danny to navigate if they disagree. And so that had me thinking, you know, did Jordan just step away and say, I'm not interested if Coach Cook is there? I would be curious what the conversation and what the dynamic around that was, but it would be tough to constantly navigate that, I feel, if I'm looking at this from Danny's perspective.
I think that's a fair argument, but we'll never know. Or maybe we will. Who knows? Maybe we'll find out someday. But was anybody else getting some fishy vibes last weekend watching like Love Omaha and things like that when Danny was in the stands? I immediately had my radar up and I was like, wait, there's a reason she's here. Did I think that the retirement announcement would come like 4 days later? Absolutely not. But with seeing her in Omaha, I'm like, wait a minute.
Signing that contract, baby.
Something's going on. But honestly, as somebody who played a small part in what became an incredible legacy for Coach Cook, I am very thankful and grateful for the opportunities that he gave me as a young student athlete. Especially in the formative years of my career, Nebraska changed my life. And so I'm so thankful for the opportunities he gave me. And, you know, as a former teammate of Danny, I'm so excited for her and I cannot wait to see what she does with this program because she's amazing. Hopefully now that everybody's heart rate's recovered from that big news this week, let's get into what has been happening around the volleyball world. So in NCAA men's volleyball, Loyola Chicago beat Pepperdine and UCSD this week, both in five sets. Hawaii and BYU had a back-to-back series. Hawaii took both of those matches. They won in 5 and 4. Pretty solid because that was a 4-5 matchup. So very nice by Hawaii. UC Irvine and Stanford also had a back-to-back series, and UC Irvine swept both of those. We actually watched those matches.
UC Irvine is good. Yeah, UC Irvine was a lot of fun to watch. They have two former National Players of the Year on that team. One's a transfer, but in the first game, they were clicking on all cylinders. They looked really good.
Their middles, too, were outstanding. Well,
their middles were good. They're a big team. In the second match, their French left side, who's also a lefty, Hanno, he seemed like he was unhappy with his teammates.
He seemed like that in the first match, too. Let's not kid ourselves.
Well,
unless the set was absolutely perfect, he was storming around the court.
Yeah, and that was an interesting dynamic to watch. And his teammates looked maybe a little more frustrated with him in the second match than in the first match. They ended up figuring it out. And at the end of the day, they're just bigger and more physical and more experienced than Stanford.
Yeah.
My concern, and as we get deeper into this, we've only watched them play once, but their setter, I think, is readable. And even Stanford, and I say even, they're still a top 10 team. Top 10 team. They always generally knew where the ball was going. They run a super high ball to their right side. I'm curious how they fare when they play some other big teams who have good blocks and are disciplined. They play USC and UCLA coming up in February. That's going to be a real test to see if their offense, namely their setter, can isolate some of their hitters and get them going, because their outside hitters are very good, but it's hard to hit against the double and triple block all the time.
Well, Flex in their right side hit like 500 in the first match, and then they held him to really low numbers in the second match. So maybe the, like, maybe they weren't passing as well. When they were running that middle, that was outstanding.
Yeah, they definitely...
So good. They need to run that middle because they set that ball to the outside so high. And I mean, the hitters are 6'8 and 6'9. Yes, of course it needs to be high, but like... Come on.
You can run a high set that still has tempo and stresses the block defense. And that wasn't happening. So we will see if that offense changes or how that looks. And don't get me wrong, their hitters could go off and score against a three-man block for a whole match. But is that the most efficient or easy way to win? No. So let's see what happens when they play against higher level of competition.
I just didn't like how different the vibe was from one night to the other. Night one, they were dominant. Mm-hmm. And then night two, it just didn't look as crisp. So I'm excited to see them play again. But that was a series that I was really excited about. USC and UCLA both went 2-0 in Columbus this weekend. They both beat Penn State and Ohio State. We'll be talking about one of those matches here shortly. But I think that was a really cool tournament with all the Big Ten teams, you know. So in NCAA men's volleyball, we still have 5 undefeated teams. Long Beach State, UC Irvine, Hawaii, USC, and Loyola Chicago are the only undefeateds left. How long is this going to last? We didn't really have any movement in the rankings this past week, like tiny moves here and there by one spot. But the top 5 stayed consistent. Long Beach State is still number 1, followed by UC Irvine and UCLA. So, yeah, we'll see what this week has in store. But this was a very jam-packed week with big matchups. So it was fun to see.
Looking at Love, the head-to-head match, Houston beat Madison 3-0. In the weekend matchups, Atlanta beat both Salt Lake 3-0 and then went on to beat Omaha 3-1. So it was a good weekend for Atlanta. And then Salt Lake City beat Austin 3-2. If we look at the league standings, Atlanta now takes over the number 1 spot, followed by Omaha, Houston, Salt Lake, Austin, and a bit of a head-scratcher, Madison, still in last place.
I'm still not okay with the fact that the team that I thought would be worse, Atlanta, is winning.
You know, you just needed to switch your predictions. Atlanta and Madison, just flip-flop them.
Like, literally flip-flop. I don't know. I'm just getting kind of, I don't want to say annoyed, but like with so few teams in Love and how they structure their weekends, I feel like I'm literally watching the same teams play each other every day.
It almost feels like friendlies to me. And it was interesting. We found something out this week that we've been talking about where the teams were organized ahead of time. The players didn't necessarily know which teams they were going to. So it was a group consensus as to what it would look like. Now, I don't know if that's going to continue moving forward, but that to me has a scripted feel.
It seems like a showcase to me, like a volleyball showcase, as opposed to like, let's create a strong team to win a league title. Like, they just seem like, let's just show good volleyball.
Do you know what it felt like to me? The analogy that I thought of was, it's like professional wrestling. There's a script and a story, and you're putting on a show. And obviously the athletes are competing on the court and they're trying to win each match, but it lacks. I want to see a GM make great moves and be rewarded. I want to see somebody be in the basement and there to be a reason for that, not a rejigging so the league has parity. Like, I want to see some of those rivalries, and they're not developing for me. The volleyball's good. You know, the athletes are out there playing, no complaints, but there's no storylines. There's no rivalries that I can feel.
Well, somebody submitted a question that was, do you think it matters who wins or loses the inaugural season of Love, or do you think it's more about storytelling?
It's storytelling.
I hate to say it, but I don't think Love cares who wins or loses, especially because one company owns every single team. Like, there's no vested interest, you know, in the same way there is with like a franchise model. So yeah, they love the story. Like, look what we're doing for women's sport. Look at the pathway we're creating, which we have said this before, is great. We love that. But when you get to the pro level, like, it's about winning. Okay. I hate to say it. Professional sports is about winning. It just feels like,
you know, the other piece of it, who's playing for a contract? Did you sign a 6-year contract?
Well, no, okay. We also got some intel. Some listeners did some detective work. Thank you very much. Sent me some messages. So apparently the salaries for Love started at $60,000.
Okay.
So lower than PVF, which started at $65,000. And then there were some that were like higher. Obviously, I'm assuming the founding athletes are making way more than that. But salary started at $60,000. And players signed either 2 or 1 year contracts.
Well, the other thing for me too is, if you want to start attracting international athletes, how are you going to sell them on, hey, just sign to Love and we'll put you somewhere?
Yeah, right? Like, I want to know, who am I competing with? Who is my coach?
Can I win?
What is my chance of winning? And what are my bonuses for winning, please and thank you? Like, I'm not just going to be like, yeah, just put my name in this pool. You know what? Salt Lake City? Great. I'll live there. Omaha? Sure. Oslo? Like, no. Tell me where I'm living, who I'm playing with, who's coaching me, and what are our realistic opportunities to win here?
Well, and we talked about this last week in terms of Lexi Rodriguez being behind Justine, and I'm not sure she had a choice. I'm curious, would she have gone there if it was up to her, or is it just a great story?
She just like was like, okay, Nebraska, I'm in this pool, and
yeah,
put me where you want.
Because her training against Justine in Omaha, like, that's a good story. But is she okay being on the bench all season? Like, it's really interesting. And again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's different. They're trying to do something, but it has lacked that rivalry to me watching the matches.
And with so many matches in the same weekend, it's just like, I'm sick of seeing the same matchups over and over and over again.
Yeah, fair.
Okay, I'll get off my soapbox now. Let's move on to PVF.
All right, if we look at PVF this week, Indy Ignite got reverse swept by Vegas for their second straight loss, boosting Vegas to the top of the standings, and Indy's dropped to 4th. So we're seeing some
surprise
movement there. Omaha and Atlanta continue to take care of business. And then Grand Rapids beat Orlando in 5, and Columbus is still struggling to get in the win column.
So like I said, Madison and Columbus, the same bottom teams, we're staying consistent there. Vegas jumped from like 5th to 1st.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, Vegas came out of nowhere and finished that reverse sweep. They've had some interesting matches, but here we are.
Cameron Hanna played well.
She did.
You're seeing more. We will get into this. Adam has done some serious work this week, everybody. So we'll get into this more later. But the rookies in PVF, you're starting to see more and more of them play big roles on their teams. Cameron Hanna played really well for Vegas, I thought. You know, Charity Looper was on the court. There was several rookies, but man, that game was
undescribable.
Like, literally, we've watched Indy play a couple times now, and it's like, you start great, and then you get really bad.
They cannot finish. Their warm-up protocols are great. They come out of the gate flying, but they cannot settle in and put a match away.
And the only time that Teeler scores is when they run a combo play. I don't think I've seen her score from the pin. I don't even know.
Once,
she scores
maybe
on the combo plays, though.
Well, the other thing about that, too, and we talked about this, is Sydney Hilly is becoming more and more predictable as the matches go on. So you see her being able to isolate her hitters early. Their scoring efficiency is higher. They're cruising as a team. And then it seems like she stops running the middle as the match goes on, just sets the quote-unquote hot hitter, and the defenses adjust, the blocks adjust, and the hitters start to struggle, and they can't close out matches. And I'm not saying it's all Sydney Hilly's fault, but that's 2 matches in a row where I've kind of seen the same thing from a decision-making and an offensive standpoint. And they're going to have to figure that out.
We're clearly very passionate about what is going on in these leagues, everybody. NCAA men's, we're cruising. We're loving it. But the other ones, we got a lot of question marks here. But it's fun to watch nonetheless. Let us know what matches you watched, what your thoughts were. But overall, a really fun week.
So one of our feature matches of the week is going to be a PVF match, and we're going to do the Grand Rapids Rise versus the Orlando Valkyrie. It was a Grand Rapids Rise victory in five. It was a good game, a lot of fun, actually. They ended up winning the second, the fourth, and the fifth set. And I'm curious what your thoughts were about that match.
Yes. The way Brittany Abercrombie was going off in set one, I was like, okay, this will be over soon.
Unstoppable.
She had like 11 kills. Every time she touched the ball, she was scoring. I was like, this is actually insane. Please stop her or make an adjustment or something. But then she completely disappeared. It was confusing. How do you go from scoring 11 kills in set one and then get six more in four sets?
Not only just six more points. Like, there was like, didn't nothing do anything. Else that happened.
Didn't get a block. Didn't get an ace.
Definitely didn't
Let
get a
Let me tell
dig.
You, wasn't digging anything. Okay.
She ended up hitting 167 in that match. How does that happen?
How do you go from hitting, kills? Like, 900 yeah. to down to 167?
Well, so on the flip side of that, the left side for Grand Rapids also played very well in the first set.
Erica Pritchard or yes. Carly Snyder?
Erica Pritchard.
Okay.
She was kind of going, I'm not going to say point for point because Abercrombie was unconscious, but she was the player, in my opinion, who kept them in the match and kept it close and gave them a chance. And it was interesting to see, and I thought that was going to be the matchup all game as to who could score more. But it, yeah, like you said, Abercrombie just kind of fell off
the cliff. Abercrombie disappeared and Pritchard elevated. I think she ended with 21 kills, hitting 340.
So if we looked at the match as a whole, in the first set it was really close. Orlando was leading most of the way, almost gave it up at the end, pulled it out 26-24. Grand Rapids Rise had a really good response. They contained Abercrombie, and they ended up winning 25-15. We saw another flip. The second and third sets weren't great.
Second, third, and fourth were just kind of blowouts.
Yeah, and so there was a bit of a lack of consistency. It was one team's passing. The other team would go on a serving run. It would be sets out to the antenna, good defense, transition. There were a lot of long rallies in this match where Grand Rapids Rise, from an eye test, seemed to come out on top of most of those and gain the momentum. But the fifth set was incredibly close. And you saw, again, I thought we had a couple players from Grand Rapids Rise step up in that fifth set. Overall, you had Erica Pritchard hit 340 on the night, which was really good. She had 50 swings. Maren Grote also played pretty well. She didn't get a ton of sets, but she was really efficient, hitting 538. Nia Chimay also played. She didn't have the most amazing match, but she got 40 swings, scored 12 points. It seemed more of a team effort from the Rise than relying on one player and not seeing it happen for Orlando.
Yeah, you have three players on the Rise who had like a significant amount of sets, but Snyder and Chimay hit under 200, both of them. Whereas like for Orlando, Abercrombie had 60 sets, and then it was pretty evenly distributed between like four other players whose numbers were pretty good, aside from Adora Ane, who hit zero.
Well, and she also got the second most set. So when you look at those two things, then it's tough.
Fair,
right?
But when you're looking at like Foster, 27 sets as a middle, that's pretty good. Kaz Brown, 22 sets as a middle. Like, I appreciate what Orlando was trying to do. And obviously, if you are usually getting production from your right side, you tend to expect it. And so I think the fact that Abercrombie kind of disappeared really made them have to force the middle a lot more to try to get something going because their producer was not delivering. But then Ane, who they also is usually their second kind of go-to player, hitting zero, that hurts as well. So the fact that this match even went five, considering that Orlando's top two hitters just tanked, is kind of shocking to me.
So then do you look at that and go, okay, if one of Orlando's outside hitters, given they won the middle battle, if one of their outside hitters had have played relatively well, they would have won that match? Is that your instinct watching it?
Okay, I can't take away from Grand Rapids. They blocked very well. Okay, and hearing the broadcast, like, that tends to be one of their strengths. We haven't really seen them play much.
So they 18 blocks for Rise to Orlando's 11.
Okay, so I think that's a significant difference.
Absolutely.
So I think you can't take away from what the Rise did. Obviously, they identified that Abercrombie needed to be stopped after set one and clearly focused their blocking attention on her 100%. If she's the only one scoring, make that adjustment. And it worked. You can see in the number of blocks they were getting, they actually started to dig a few more balls. In the first set, I was like, your block defense is like on a different planet. The fact that, and even like you say they won the middle battle, Orlando, I think Marin Grote played very well. Even though she only got 13 sets compared to the other middles, 20 plus, almost 30, I didn't think that the middles for Orlando were, I didn't notice them. Like, I'm surprised to see that they got that many sets. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I thought Marin was great away from the ball. I thought she was a linchpin for their block defense. She got a ton of touches. Like, she, to me, is a player who does things that don't necessarily show up on the score sheet. And I thought she was noticeable just from a block touch, be an option, hold the other middle. And, you know, those things you don't always see. But looking at some of the numbers, Rise kind of won all of the categories. 6-3 in aces for the Rise. If we look at the attack efficiency, Rise hit 259 to Orlando's 194. As I said before, they outblocked them 18-11. They outdug them 84-75. And while those aren't necessarily huge statistical leadings, you're winning in all of the categories. And we had some blowouts and players, you know, some of these numbers are inflated because you have a bad set or you have a great set. But overall, I think they were a little more consistent than Orlando was.
What I'm about to say is kind of a big difference for me between PVF and Love right now is that there's one person who kind of made a difference. If you look at the stats and you compare, like Erica Pritchard made the difference. And it's not like her numbers were off the charts. Like 340, that's a good night, but it's not like an outside going up and hitting like 600 or something. You know what I mean? One player was able to elevate her team to take the win. Carly Snyder didn't attack particularly well. Nia Shime didn't attack particularly well. They didn't run their middles a ton. On the other side, Abercrombie got set a ton of balls, didn't score that many. Ane, same thing. The middles, they were producing okay, but like it literally was like pretty even across the board. Like if you're looking at the outsides from both sides, the middles from both sides, pretty even playing field. It literally took one player to push the difference, and I don't think you're seeing that in Love. In Love, you're seeing, obviously players have good games, but you're seeing more than one player needing to step up.
Yeah, and you're seeing more lapses. We saw a lot of runs in that match. So, for example, in the fourth set, Snyder went on a 7-0 serving run. Like, that can't happen.
And the crazy thing, too, I was pulling my hair out at this, watching that game. Grand Rapids could not set a transition ball to save their lives.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up. So their second contact was not very good, even though they got a bunch of good block touches. But on the flip side, Orlando didn't adjust their defensive position. So when they would be out of system and have a terrible second contact, they would stay packed into the court, and then the Grand Rise hitters would hit into the back of the court. As soon as you see that ball off the net, the Orlando defense needed to take a step back, protect the outside of the court, have the front court left side come in for the tips, and you would have had way more controlled touches. When Orlando got them out of system, or Grand Rapids just didn't execute for whatever reason, they didn't take advantage of those opportunities.
Grand Rapids was like either getting blocks, or if they dug, they were almost sending a free ball over every time. I was beside myself watching this transition setting. You're professional athletes here, and you're telling me that you cannot get a hittable ball up to your hitter after a dig? I was shocked that they were managing to stay ahead in this match, because I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah, they're going to have a week's worth of transition setting practice.
I hope so.
Has to be.
I hope so.
Because on the flip side, if we talk about Orlando's outsides being able to score some points to win that match, if Grand Rapids can hit some out-of-system balls effectively, their block defense is giving them chances. So you're making and you're doing all of the work to get the chance, and you can't execute on the one skill that allows you to transition that success into points. And it'll be interesting to see if they can kind of figure that out.
Speaking of setting, I was not a fan of either setter in that match.
Fair.
I did appreciate August Raskey's offensive mindset. She really pulled out some interesting swings at the right times, which also has to keep the block defense honest. But as far as decision making and set location for these setters, I struggled.
Do you think that has anything to do with the ball control being inconsistent in this match, or just straight decision making?
I will have to watch them play more, but I didn't like their location and some of the decisions they made. I was like, what? I wish I could understand what you were thinking.
So I think one of the things that we'll start to see, and we'll get to this later, is there's a lot of turnover on roster spots. A lot of young players are pushing through and seeing. So I'm wondering if setters are still trying to figure out who they can set in big moments and what the flow should be, and, you know, learning their hitters in game situations. Because there's been, again, a lot of fluctuation in terms of who's playing and who's coming in. So I'm curious to see if it's just a general limitation or if there's going to be a personnel learning curve on some of these teams.
Well, because the lineups that we were seeing a couple weeks ago are not even close to the same.
Nope. So I think we're going to see more and more of those first-year college players starting to take roster spots. My last kind of note from this match before we move on to the men's matches is Orlando continued to go to the double sub with Lydia Grote, and it never worked. I mean, if you're trying to get Lydia some playing time to get her in because you think that she's going to be able to add to your totals later on, totally fair. If you're doing it from a strategic position, you did it again and again and again, and then again in the fifth set, and I believe she made at least one error in that situation in a tight match trying to close it out. I get that the double sub is a good thing, but you also have to have a pulse on if it's working or not in that match, and I thought that was a bad decision.
Well, particularly like you're creating this double sub to take away a small setter from the block. And I don't recall if she was lined up with Pritchard or Pritchard was lined up with Abercrombie. But she didn't block anything.
Nope.
Like, it's not like Orlando was getting extra defensive opportunities because they put a bigger block up and they weren't scoring more points because Grote wasn't scoring. So, yeah. It was interesting that they kept choosing to go back to that. Maybe they're trying to build for the future. I don't know.
Well, and that's, to me, that's the only way that that's a legitimate decision. Overall, I thought it was an entertaining match. Some of the sets were blowouts. It could have been a little bit closer in the middle of that match. But there were a lot of storylines to follow. Athletes coming and going, playing well. Who you're going to run, who's going to come out on top. I enjoyed watching that match. So we asked the question last week, should we continue to cover men's matches? And there were a lot of people who were very interested in getting coverage and having us continue to talk about that. So we are definitely going to do that. We watched a bunch of men's matches this weekend, notably Ohio State and UCLA, which we're going to talk about now. While the rallies in the women's game make it, I would say, a little more exciting, man, watching some of these men's players is, it's just incredible what they can do. Let's get into it, but I had a ton of fun watching men's volleyball this week.
This was a particularly fun match to watch. It was a rematch from a couple weeks ago when Ohio State upset the then number one UCLA in four. So needless to say, UCLA was coming out hoping for a better outcome than they had a couple weeks ago. And they did. UCLA 1-4. Ohio State took the first set.
Correct.
On the heels of what I would say were just like so many UCLA serving errors.
And hitting errors.
Errors.
Just bad all the way around.
UCLA was either getting an ace or it was like, watch out if you're in the stands. So I'm like, okay. Seeing the first set, I'm like, Ohio State's passing is suspect. It was not. They are not a solid passing team, in my opinion. But UCLA just couldn't keep the ball in to exploit it.
So before we get into some of the tactical and what happened in the match, I think not a lot of people are aware of even the players on some of these teams. So let's highlight a couple of the key players for each team, and then we can talk about some of the strategy. Let's start with UCLA. I think that their strength generally lies on their outside. So they have two incredibly dynamic outside hitters in Cooper Robinson and Zach Rama. These are big boys. They jump well. Watching them hit is incredible. They're a little inconsistent, but I think that's one of their strengths. And their setter's ability to deliver a tempo high set from anywhere on the court was impressive to watch.
100%. I agree. The UCLA strengths are their setting and their outside hitters. They were missing their opposite, Ido David, that match.
The man among children.
Oh my gosh, this man serve everybody. I know we talked about it a few weeks ago, but he was not playing. He wasn't even on the bench. As we're talking about that, this match, keep that in mind. On the flip side, I think Ohio State's strength is in their right side.
Correct. His name is Shane Wetzel, and he, for a right side, first of all, I'm just going to shout out, he made a lot of digs.
Wowee.
There was a stretch where he was at the service line. I think they scored 5 points in a row. He was unloading from the service line. He made at least 2 digs that were playable. And for those of you who think that digging is impressive or not impressive because you watch mostly women's volleyball, let me tell you, 2 digs from your right side on the men's side and 6 points, game changer. And he followed those up by scoring from the back row. I was thoroughly impressed with how he played this match.
I think across the board, UCLA is just more skilled. But in watching this match, I think Ohio State has found a way to maximize the players and the skills that they do have. Whereas, and I thought that they were more consistent overall, whereas UCLA was very up and down. And I don't know if it was a focus thing or what it was, but they have the skill, but they need to maintain that focus and that intensity, whereas Ohio State is maybe a little less skilled, but they were doing everything they could with what they have. So I think that that's why the match was like so close. If UCLA can dial in their mentality and just like do work, they could be unbelievable. But the runs and the ups and downs are too frequent.
I completely agree with your analysis. So a couple of things that struck me.
If you're going to say that is young men for you, because that's always your excuse when I talk about men's volleyball or college men's volleyball, you're like, oh yeah, that's young men. I don't care.
So I would say that Ohio State had a blue collar work ethic and they were grinding. I thought the libero for Ohio State played very well in that match. The thing that's noticeable is, I would say, the athleticism. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the Ohio State players can't jump.
No, they really couldn't, though.
But when you watch them, when you watch them jump and contact the ball versus the outside hitters for UCLA, it's a bit of a different stratosphere. They're playing at a different level. The UCLA boys have that surfer mentality. We're flipping the hair back on the service line. We're a little nonchalant. You know, there's a little bit of swagger there, and I agree that it's not business all the time. And so you saw in the first set, UCLA missed a ton of serves. It was absurd. And then their outside hitters were calibrated, you know, half a foot out of bounds. And they were swinging hard, but they weren't gelling. Now, I noticed in the second set, they took 15% off their serves. They kept the ball in. And then all of a sudden,
and Ohio State's passing was still bad.
Yeah. But if you look at that match, UCLA had 25 block assists on that match. No solo, no solo blocks, which meant that as a team, they knew exactly what was going on. They had big blocks on every hit when the ball was in play. And that was in comparison to only 8 block assists from Ohio State. So when they kept the ball in, and they still serve tough when they're serving 15% off their hard serves.
I think my wrist would snap if I tried to pass one of those. I have skinny wrists. It would be fractured.
Well, and so when you look at their ability to block and play defense in that regard, I'm curious if their coach is going, hey, go out on the first set, just unload. Let's see where our serving goes. We're going to work on that for later on in the season. And then when they lost, it's dial it back. We're going to keep it in. We're going to play block defense, or whether they just found it. Like, I'm curious what that adjustment was, because it was distinct. It definitely was planned.
The thing for me when we're talking about the focus and the mentality is when I see 3 juicy overpasses be completely mishandled, you are not focused. And it was happening at critical times. At one point, Robinson goes up, hammers it out of bounds. Then twice, their right side, Decker, faked hitting it, and then the ball just landed and then hammered it into the stands. Like, if you're getting overpasses, for me, that is a great indicator of where your mind is at. And as a team, if you're messing them up, you're not focused. You're not dialed in the way you need to be. And I will say, I think UCLA would have lost without their setter, Andrew Rowan, because he was their most consistent player from top to bottom, from the service line, for delivery of the set. He kept the team together. He was the one who was serving for all these overpasses. I can't even imagine what was going through his head seeing these guys mess them up.
If I'm a setter at that point and you mess up my overpass, I'm walking up to you and I'm telling you, you're not getting sets for 5 balls. Figure it out.
Adam would never do that. He's too nice. I would do that. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, you talk about David Decker, and I thought he was a roller coaster.
He was a liability.
Well, there were stretches where he was all world and he was hitting a
I must have missed those points.
But he was very streaky. So it was either, you know, 7 good swings in a row and then, you know, miss, overpass, miss, out to lunch. And then he would come back. He just seemed to come in and out of the match at different times. And that was, it was interesting because you talk about Cooper Robinson missing that overpass. So he misses that overpass.
I was ripping him in new
one. Sarah was losing her mind as we were watching this game.
I think he knew.
And then they set him. He sides out. And then he goes back to the baseline and rips 2 aces and finishes the match. And she goes, oh, okay, I'm fine with that.
No, I was like, good, you had to make up for that. Thank you so much. You needed to score those points.
And we didn't see that same response from Decker.
Oh, no. No. But my other thing is like, Rama, when he chooses to, goes over top of the block.
The ceiling of...
But then sometimes he's like bringing it down into the block. And I don't know if that's like an experience thing, if it's a attention to detail thing. But it's like when you are approaching hard, when you're fully extended, when you're executing, you are unstoppable. Like, let's replicate that, you know, for more than a couple swings in a row. Because I think he is so good. I love that kid. But I'm like, let's build some consistency.
So I'm really curious, 2 things. I think UCLA has a ton of high-end potential. Their ceiling is very high if they can put everything together. And even though their middles are a little undersized, they're very dynamic. They're very quick. They close the block well. They get up early. They can score. And their setter uses them well. But if their outsides, all 3 are clicking at once, they're going to be really, really tough to stop because they're also a very good blocking team. I'm really curious to see them play some other high-end opponents and see if they can get to that level consistently for a whole match.
I always think that my only knock on Rowan, the setter, is he could have set the middle more. His Rama and Robinson are his security blanket. It's just like, oh, yeah, just give them the ball. But I think he needs to set the middle more.
I think it's going to depend on who they're playing. If their outsides can dominate the other team's outsides, he'll just set them because he runs the ball fast enough. His contact point on his set and how he flings it out to the antennas, it's flat, it's high, it's on the mark. If they start to move out and teams are putting two blockers on there and leaving the middle, he'll have to be able to find them to open them back up. So that will be their kind of struggle against top teams. But I'm looking forward to seeing them play UC Irvine coming up.
As much as I loved Rowan, I thought Rodriguez, the setter for Ohio State, struggled. Agreed. I know he's a freshman. Okay, I'm aware. But I thought his delivery was not as clean. I did, however, like how he ran the middle.
He forced the middle, and he had to because Ohio State didn't really pass that well. So, I mean, you are putting a freshman setter in a tough place, but yeah, he was outplayed in that match, I would say blatantly.
As we were saying, the outsides for UCLA outperformed the Ohio State outsides. We were saying that the Ohio State right side battle, they won that. I think that, honestly, Ohio State might have won the middle battle.
I think that's fair.
Especially from an offensive perspective.
Yeah. I also thought...
They were up. Their arm was back. They were loaded. It was run well, and they were very efficient.
I would agree with that. I also thought Ohio State won the libero battle.
Agreed. I didn't even notice the UCLA libero.
Yeah.
I thought the passing libero was better than the defensive one, but like I wasn't getting much from them, but I thought the Ohio State libero made some great digs.
Well, and he... Kudos to him. He was strapping it on. He got hit by a few balls that were
I would have had cardiac arrest
missiles. It was wow, and he just stood in there and dug ball. It was impressive to watch. I'm curious to see Ohio State. I want to see them play a BYU, a Hawaii, you know, some teams. I mean, Hawaii State's not small, but they're not playing at that same level as some of those other teams. I want to see if their mentality can grind them out some wins against the like 5-12 range opponents. So I'm curious to see how that goes for them because I think they have the makings of a team that forces you to beat them. And if you don't show up, they will win.
Like when I watched Penn State play, like I thought, and again, I haven't watched either team a ton, but I think Ohio State is better than Penn State.
Yeah.
They just can't find a win against a top team. Obviously, they upset UCLA. That is their one win against a top team. But, like, I do think they're capable.
Yeah, I do, too. They just don't have that high-end point score unless Wetzel is unconscious.
They need something more from their left sides.
Yeah. Overall, I had so much fun getting into that men's match, and we watched a few other matches. It was good, and after the first set they didn't miss too many serves, so there was some action to actually watch and pay attention to. I will say, and we're going to do my hot take right now.
Oh,
I have never seen so many men volley the ball the net on third contact. Get out of there, get it out of the way. I don't want to see it. I'm not interested.
It wasn't just this match, it was all the men's matches we were watching. We're like, when did jump volleying it over become a thing?
Tip the ball, find
take
a spot,
a rip,
take a swing. I know you don't want to make an error, but a jump volley, get that out of here. I don't
just
see
like
that.
Think of how many errors you're making on your serve. Let's have the same mentality offensively, okay? Just go for it. Ugh. I don't want to see you jumping and volleying the ball down.
That's my rant on the men's volleyball that I watched.
It was fun to watch, though.
All right. So instead of a game this week, we had so many people asking about how are the recent graduates from the NCAA doing in the American Professional Leagues? Where are we at? What's going on now that we're, you know, a month and a bit in, what are your thoughts? So I did a deep dive into all of the players who were drafted, who are on teams, who played in college last year, and we're going to go over some of those. We're going to talk about the highlights. I'm going to give you an overview of how many there are, what teams they're on, and then we'll talk about the ones making the biggest difference. So if we look at Love, obviously we had the Love Six, so they pulled six of the recruits or top NCAA players into their league. And out of all of them, four are making a significant contribution. So Rachel Fairbanks is obviously playing a ton of games at the setter position for Atlanta. I think she's doing well. The team is cruising along. So instant impact. She's doing great. I think we both liked her as a setter. I'm not surprised. Madison Skinner also played 4 of 5 for Austin. She is finding her way. She hasn't been amazing. She's got 58 points on the season, you know, 25% kill efficiency, you know, 120 attacks. She's doing okay. I think she will continue to get better. Her ceiling's higher. She's playing a new position. Feel free to hop in and give your take on any of these players.
I agree with both of those.
Jess Merzick playing all the matches for Houston, getting set a ton of balls, having a pretty good season, 73 points, 24% efficient. She is blocking. She is serving aces. She is digging. They're nowhere without her, in my opinion. And so I think we both really like Jess Merzick. We talked about her finding hands and being able to swing against a bigger block, and that was going to help her transition. I think that's definitely true. Finally, Sarah Franklin played 6 of 6 matches. She has the most points out of any of the rookies at 84. She's 28% efficient, 78 kills. She's been set almost 200 times since they've started, passing relatively well. Not as effective on the blocks and aces as Merzick is, but she's making a lot of digs too. So I would say that's been a pretty successful transition.
I'm honestly surprised that Franklin and Merzick are, when they graduated, I thought that those two, I had question marks about how they would transition into the pro game, and they have proven me wrong. I personally think Merzick is playing outstanding. I think she is the top rookie in love right now. But we actually did have a question of why are so many rookies playing over veterans or Team USA players? And honestly, I think it's because they're playing better. And there's not the same hierarchy necessarily in pro that you sometimes see in high school or college. As we were saying, we do have some issues with kind of like the vibe of love. But at the end of the day, the pro game is about winning. And the college players came into these seasons game ready.
And I think that's a huge piece.
They had been playing for 4.5 months already. And there's something to say about walking into a team, being game ready, and having that playing experience very recent, as opposed to having taken an entire summer and fall off. So I think there are a couple things at play, like I just mentioned, the readiness piece, but also I think that these young players are playing better than some of the veterans who maybe they have something to prove. They are trying to build their career. They don't have that same reputation and clout to be able to fall back on, so they've got something to prove. And I'm curious if these veterans are going to push back or if they're like, cool.
And I also think from a coaching perspective, you know, you had some of those vets out there earlier, but you give them a chance. The rookies come in. They haven't been with the teams as long as the other players, but as they start to find their rhythm, you've given your vets a chance. You have done your due diligence in terms of kind of honoring their experience and doing that. And now it's earn it. Like, show up and play. And the rookies have had a chance to fit into the team dynamics, to understand the systems, and you're seeing them play more and more in both leagues.
Okay, that was only a fraction of your research. Let's hit us with the juice.
All right, so then the last two, you have Lexi Rodriguez, who we've talked about at length and is seeing no playing time other than a sub or two. And then Sophie Fisher, who's playing for Salt Lake. She's been subbed in and out, but hasn't been a regular contributor to the lineup. So she's only had, you know, 22 points, 27 attempts. So she's still figuring her way out there in Salt Lake City. Now, as we transition to PVF, it gets a little more, let's call it messy. There are 45 total first-year rookies in the PVF league.
Now, that's crazy.
Yeah, not all of them are playing or making contributions. So we have about 10 that are seeing regular playing time. The way I broke this down was you had to have played in more than half of your team's matches and not just in a substitution standpoint. So I want to do this real quick. We'll go team by team, and I'll tell you how many first years they have and then who's playing. So if we start with Atlanta, Atlanta has 8 rookies on their roster. The ones who are seeing playing time are Merritt Beeson and Corey Lewis. So they've both played all of their matches. Beeson's putting up great numbers. She's got 85 points. She's hitting almost 24%. She's had 200 swings, 6 blocks, 5 aces, 46 digs. She is exactly what they expected her to be at this point. You also have Corey Lewis playing in the middle, also played all of the matches, 46 points, hitting almost 50%. She's got 9 blocks. She's making digs. Those two have been staples for that team and done a really good job.
And then Mia Tuoniga is like coming into the roster now, but like hasn't played as much as the other ones.
Correct. So if we look at Columbus, they have 5 total players. Kaylee Cox is an outside hitter. She's played 6 of 6 matches, also doing a good job. 74 points, 31% efficient. She's taken 190 swings. She's adding 12 blocks, making digs. So she's been a real bright spot for Columbus, even though they're not winning any matches. And then you have Abby Walker, middle blocker from Cincinnati, played 6 of 6 matches, has decent stats, but is a regular player for them. Looking at Grand Rapids, they have 5 rookies. None of them are playing. So you have a couple subs. Jenna Ortek from Purdue has been in a bunch of matches. They have a couple liberos also in Elena Ogilvy. Naya Shimei has been kind of there. She's breaking through. I think you're going to see her starting to play more. She's had 120 sets and she's hitting fairly efficiently, but those rookies haven't broken in and are consistent starters at this point. Moving on to Indy, 7 rookies in this one. Also 2 making contributions. You have Caroline Crawford, not unexpected here. She was coming in. She played for Wisconsin. She's been in 4 of 5 of their matches. 30 points, 32% efficient, 51 attempts, blocking really well at 11 so far, and she's a staple for them, along with Nina Chayich, who's also played a ton for them. She's racked up 62 points, hitting almost 29% efficient. She's had 190 sets, so they're relying on her. She's done a really good job for them, also defensively with 45 digs. We're almost there. Omaha, 7 rookies. None of them really playing.
Not even Batenhorst?
No, Batenhorst she's played 2 of their 5 matches. She's been okay. 27 points, 84 swings, no blocks, no aces, 8 digs. She's coming in. She's played recently. We'll see where she goes, but I wouldn't say she's been a huge contributor at this point. If we look at Orlando, we have Natalie Foster from SMU playing middle. She's been in 5 of 6 of their matches. 60 points, 47% efficient. So she's been scoring really well. They've been setting her. More impressively, it's 13 blocks, 10 aces, 12 digs. We saw her serve in the college game, and it's transitioned for her really well. So she's been really good. And then San Diego's got 3. Layla Blackwell, the 3rd middle from Nebraska, playing all of their matches. 28 points, very efficient at 38, getting set 61 times. 5 blocks, 7 digs. She's been stable for them. Not a superstar, but I think what you expected of her. And then finally, if we look at Vegas, they also have 5. Cameron Hanna has played 5 of 7 matches, 61 points, very efficient at 37%, 144 swings. She's blocking, serving aces, making digs. And then Charity Looper, also an outside hitter. So interestingly, they have 2 rookie outsides. She's played 4 of 7, but she's also 54 points, 42%, 150 sets, digging, blocking, serving aces. So that's kind of your rookie roundup. That's where they're at. I think we've seen some of the players we saw in the NCAA play really well, making a good transition in the PVF, and I would expect that to continue. I think you'll see more and more of these young players who we didn't talk about, Notably, Anna DeBeer is there. You have Elena Scott, who has a chance to come through, and a few other high-end college players who I think we'll see make a difference on their teams down the stretch.
So of all the people who came in from college, we're seeing about a third of them, little less than a third of them, making significant contributions to their teams. So we'll see how many, you know, kind of stick it out for the long run, how many will start to make more contributions later in the season, and how that will go. But we can post Adam's sheets on Instagram if you guys want to take a closer peek. We got a lot of listener questions this week, so I have them all recorded. So if we don't hit your question this week, don't worry, I have them all down. But I've selected a few to discuss this week. Our first question is, now that it has been a couple of weeks, has your view of the level of play between PVF and Love changed? No.
So I'm going to go into it a little more detail than just the no you got from Sarah. I think,
if anything, it's gotten more. The chasm has widened for me.
So I'm seeing two things. I'm seeing one, just the size and reach of the athletes is pretty different from league to league. So, you know, if you look at, like, let's take Teeler and Member Mena, for example. Super physical athletes, you know, technically sound, but they're 5'9", they're 5'8", and you're seeing the outside hitters in Love are 6'4", 6'5", they're your Sarah Franklins, they're your Jess Merziks, and then you have, you know, your Thompsons. They're just bigger athletes, and it's less about the volleyball per se, and more about the physicality of the game, I would say.
And the consistency.
And the consistency. But the other piece of that, too, is the setters are just so much more experienced in Love. And when those experienced players are touching the ball every second contact, they can fix a lot of things. They can make good decisions. They put their hitters in better places. Those are my two kind of stark observations from these first several weeks.
And I think something to keep in mind is, like, because we're saying that the level is different, it doesn't take away from the entertainment factor or the enjoyment of watching one versus the other. The Love athletes are better volleyball players. They are more polished, they're more consistent, they're bigger, they're more physical. The PVF players, like we said a few weeks ago, are more of an extension of the college game. These are the players in PVF who probably wouldn't make a great career overseas, who probably wouldn't be able to make a living, for like a good living, playing overseas, but they have been given this opportunity. Because these players are playing against athletes of a similar caliber, it is entertaining. But I think if you were to take a random PVF team and put them against a Love team, it would not be fun to watch because it would be very one-sided. So each league, the volleyball is fun to watch in its own way, but you cannot compare the level that the game is being played at.
And the height.
If you truly understand volleyball and you have actually played the game, you know what I'm talking about. And from a fan perspective, that is what makes volleyball so beautiful. Is like, you don't have to understand the game and you don't have to understand how technically sound or physical players are to derive enjoyment from it. And so I think the levels are completely different, and that is totally fine. But if anything, I think the difference in the abilities is more clear now than it was earlier.
I will say I really like the competitiveness and the intensity that the PVF has managed to generate in their league. And that goes back to, you know, what we talked about in terms of owners trying to do things and players going back and forth. So I've enjoyed that, but that's what I'm seeing.
Our second question is, how does the subbing work in the leagues?
So great question. Let's give a little context. College is 15 subs, unlimited. You can do whatever you want. International is 6 subs in and out once per athlete. That means once you've come off the bench onto the floor and you go back onto the bench, you cannot come back in. So Love and PVF both have 8 subs per set. Now, the difference is in Love, it's similar to the college rules where the players can go in and out and in and out. So you see Omaha doing the double sub, And they can do that because you can come in and out. PVF also has 8 subs, but they play the international rule. So you'll see a player come in, maybe serve once, and then come back off the floor and can't go back in. You're seeing that with an Elena Scott, for example. So while they have the same numbers, the rules around what you can do are slightly different.
And our final question of the week is, what new athletes do you think could make the U.S. 2028 Olympic team?
First and foremost, I think you have to understand how the U.S. plays volleyball internationally. Generally, they are middle dominant. Their middles have been incredibly talented and at the top of the world for several cycles now. They seem to pump out middles who can score, who can block at an incredible rate. In order to utilize them, your ball control needs to be on point. So you are seeing left sides like Jordan who are ball controlled. Justine Wongarontis, who has great ball control, is the libero there. They need to be in system to be successful. And so as everybody's kind of looking at Jess Merzick and Sarah Franklin and saying, are we going to see them make that jump? And I think one of those two could potentially be on the team on the bench to come in as a sub in 2028 when they need a little size, unless their ball control improves greatly. They are not going to win, and I say they, the U.S. is not going to win at the Olympics if those passers are passing at the attack line and then having to hit out of system. So that's on the left side. I think Maddie Skinner, so the one thing in my opinion that the U.S. has lacked is a super terminal opposite. And Maddie Skinner has the potential to be that because she's physical enough, but I'm not there to say she's that
player yet. I
don't
think it'll be her. I think it'll be Olivia Babcock.
I
think at the international level and the way the international game is played, Olivia Babcock is the type of opposite player you want on the court. The U.S. has always fallen behind other powerhouse countries in the opposite position. They haven't had a beast terminal opposite like you see from the Italians, the Serbians, the Turkish teams. Like, as Adam said, the U.S. has gotten by with incredible ball control, running an incredibly fast offense, and having dominant middles. I think to get to that next level, I think Olivia Babcock will step in. I think Jess Merzick could be a typical, like, outside. I feel like the U.S. system and the way that they play is going to change.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I think Lexi Rodriguez could be on the team as a backup libero because you do need two. But I haven't seen any middles. I think Andy Jackson potentially could be on the U.S. team in 2028. I think compared to some of the middles out there, she's a little smaller internationally.
Do you see Dana Retke being on there? Do you see...
Oh, Dana Retke's already on the team.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. Do you see her as being
I think Retke could step in. I think I was thinking like current or recently graduated college players.
Totally fair. That just popped into my head out of curiosity as you were talking about Jackson.
Okay, so yeah, Retke, I think. So Jackson, I think Babcock. I wouldn't be surprised if Rachel Fairbanks enters the system because Carlini stepped away. Rodriguez, I think, could... There's a few, but I think the U.S. definitely needs to step up their right side game, and they need to... Avery Skinner has kind of stepped into the similar role that I just outlined for Jess Merzick, so I'm not sure if Merzick will beat her out, but those are the players that come to mind for me.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I wouldn't write Maddie Skinner off just based on how physical she is if she steps in there and she can be that dynamic, but... I wasn't thinking about Babcock, and I think that's a good choice too. So it'll be interesting to see if they get chances and how they perform this summer even in some of that play.
Again, thanks so much to all of you who submit questions. If I didn't get to your question this week, don't worry, it will be coming. But we also answered some throughout the episode. So if it wasn't in the actual section, we may have addressed it throughout the episode. But thank you so much to all of you who take the time to write to us.
All right. Looking forward to the week coming up. Here's what we have our eye on. Here's what we're going to be watching. On Wednesday, the Love head-to-head match features Houston and Austin. So we got a little Texas showdown. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern on Love Live. Hopefully we don't get any black screens. And the Women's Sport Network. The Weekend with Love will be in Salt Lake City this weekend. The Friday match will be on Love Live and DAZN. And Saturday matches on Love Live and the Women's Sport Network. As we get into the NCAA men's action, if you want to stay up late, on Thursday and Saturday at midnight Eastern, Stanford plays Hawaii.
That's too late for me.
That should be a good game. I might be up to watch that one. On Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern, UCLA plays Long Beach State. I think that's going to be an incredible match. I want to go see
that. I'm excited. I haven't seen Long Beach State play yet. I've wanted to, but their games have been hard to find.
Yeah, so that... I would circle that one on the calendar as being...
We might go to that one live, yeah, even.
So we'll see. We'll see. And then in the PVF on Friday at 10 Eastern, you got the Vegas Thrill playing the San Diego Mojo. On Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern, the Omaha Supernovas play Atlanta Vibe. And those matches can both be found on YouTube on the PVF channel. I will say, occasionally... the PVF matches show up on the Volleyball World TV.
That going through it lately.
Yeah, short notice. I was looking for it on YouTube, and then somebody posted that it had moved stations. So if you can't find it on YouTube, check Volleyball World TV.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.